I first found out about our current speaker today by an article that I saw in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I believe it was February 12, 2001, and I was rather intrigued by what I read about him. Carl Weinberg is going to be talking about renewable energy in California. And as everyone's aware, recent events in California have brought energy back into the limelight, and that's rather the subtle way of putting it. Carl Weinberg is the principal of Weinberg Associates, which he founded in June 1993 after 19 years with Pacific Gas and Electric Company. At PG&E, he managed and grew an internationally respected energy research and development program. Weinberg Associates was formed with the primary objective of accelerating the introduction of renewable and distributed power systems. His company has been working on policy issues and technical considerations in the restructuring of the utility industry, with particular emphasis on the concept of sustainability in a competitive framework and the introduction of distributed resources. Carl Weinberg is also a member of the board of Renewable Energy Policy Project, an associate of the Regulatory Assistance Program, RAPs. He is a senior associate of Winrock International, and serves on the PEER, Public Interest Energy Research Evaluation Panel in California. He's also affiliated with the Global Business Network, involved in strategic and scenario planning, and a fellow of the California Council on Science and Technology. Prior to joining PG&E in 1974, Carl spent 21 years in the United States Air Force in various assignments involving research and development management in bioscience. He has a BS and MS in engineering from the UC Berkeley, which he received in 1952, 1954, and an MS in physics from Vanderbilt University in 1960. He's a registered civil engineer, a member of the California Civil Engineering Honor Society, a number of other organizations. And as I said, I saw this article about Carl, and I wanted to read to you briefly a little quote from him. The article was entitled, "A Lost Opportunity That Worsened Crisis, The Green Energy We Didn't Get," by Susan Sword at the SF Chronicle. And it says, there's a little caption that says, "Big Smokestack Syndrome." Carl Weinberg, the respected former head of Pacific Gas and Electric Company, research department in the 1980s and early 1990s, said the utility philosophy was real men build power plants with big smokestacks on top. The quote, "The utilities were extremely successful from 1900 through 1980 by building ever bigger power plants and dropping the cost of electricity," said Weinberg, who retired in 1993. "When changes began to happen with federal law in 1978 requiring the utilities to sign contracts with the renewable industry, the environmental movement got going and technological change occurred. The utilities protected their paradigms. They didn't know how to operate in a world that included renewables." Weinberg said he had recommended that PG&E needed to look at smaller plants, including microturbines and solar, to provide a more diversified, reliable power base in the modern information age, when blackouts in places such as Silicon Valley could be disastrous. We all know what's happened so far. It never really penetrated, Weinberg said of his advisors. At the time, they were worried about deregulation. Their focus began to go elsewhere. It was, the utilities critics say, a fatal error in judgment by the utilities, and it occurred at a time when renewable sources such as wind and solar were making major technological advances. Now, I can't think of a more appropriate thing for us to have at the Tesla Society, considering that one of the primary reasons that Nikola Tesla got into creating the electric grid that we know and love so dearly today based on alternating current was, before him, alternating current was pretty much a curiosity only, not seen to have any practical value. And the only industrial use of power was direct current, and it meant that you had to have a power plant every few miles, and that meant a lot of coal, a lot of oil plants. And he wanted to build, he wanted to change the electric grid so that you could transport power hundreds or thousands of miles, and it meant you could get power from clean sources such as dams, to and such as the hydroelectric plant that he helped design, he designed really at Niagara Falls, over to major cities in, such as New York and over across the country. So he was along for, although, you know, there's clearly still a need for coal and oil at this time, moving in this direction towards more clean energy sources, whatever we can do in that area, is a positive step, and I'm sure that Tesla would be supportive of that. So we're glad to have Carl Weinberg with us today. Please welcome Carl Weinberg.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I guess I'm just going to have to watch what I tell reporters, you know. But it's a pleasure for me to be here. And in the light of all the stuff that's going on, I thought I'd focus a lot on what's happening in the electrical system and not as much on renewables, though I can talk about that, and particularly how it fits into the structure into which we're evolving. And just so that you know something about me is that I used to be a pretty good engineer, and then I became a manager, and then you lose all the engineering skills you have, okay? And then I retired, and then you don't have anyone to manage. So there's nothing left but philosophy, okay? So I'm going to, a lot of what you're going to hear from me are sort of my own views of what's going on. I put down here and said most people have a disclaimer. I have a claimer. And I'm provocative, and I'm a contrarian, and a lot of the opinions are my own. Not everybody agrees with me. I love questions. I grew up in a family where everyone talked at once, which was a real problem when I first got married. My wife came from a family where you were very polite. You didn't say anything, and you asked people to pass things, you know, and my family, you just grabbed, and everybody yelled at everybody. So it was a while for us to come to a mode of operation. She still thinks I talk too loud and talk too much. But I don't have any problem with you interrupting at any time, asking any questions, because it really is a lot more fun to respond to the kind of questions you have than for me to just be didactic and go through a set of slides as I go along. And so what I thought I would do is I would talk a little bit. This is sort of the outline. I talk a little bit about the forces and the laws that led to the fact of what all of you now recognize as chaos in the electrical industry, basically. And then what California did. We talk about it a lot, but a lot of people don't know what really was in AB 1890. I don't know if you've heard that term or not, but that's the law that was passed by the California legislature, which led to the sort of situation that you have today. Okay. Whoops, what happens here? I'm still not up to, I got to get back to the, I guess I have to talk faster, this stuff just quits on me, okay? Where am I? Previous, there. Okay, and then I'll talk a little bit about renewables and how they fit into what California's doing, and then I'm not getting much into the technology. If you want me to, I can certainly do that. And then I thought one of the problems that I always have is that nowhere in all this business that's going on has anyone put forth a vision of the future. You know, where is it we ought to be going? We ought to be debating about that. It's hard to decide we ought to be drilling for more oil if we don't know where the hell we're going, right? I mean, this is, and you'll see what I have, is if you don't know where you're going, any road will do. So one of the things you need to know is where you're going, right? So anyway, don't be afraid to interrupt me, ask questions. Okay, let me talk about major forces at work. And I've got three of them up here, and I call them governance, environment, and technology. Okay, in the terms of governance, we clearly, we've gone through, in this century, we've gone through all kinds of isms, socialism, communism, capitalism, and all that kind of stuff. What finally emerged triumphant, whether you like it or not, are markets and market-based systems. Okay, now, my own personal view is there are no free markets. Every market I know of is a construct by people. It all has a set of regulations that go with it. You can name any market you can think of. There's either health and safety laws, some other things with it. In fact, one of the biggest capitalists in the world, George Soros, in his book on international capitalism, says a system based entirely on greed will not lead to social cohesion. So even he recognizes that markets are ways to get things done that you want done as a society, and that so you have to structure them. So there's nothing free about it. But clearly, we've deregulated trains, we've deregulated the airplane industry, we deregulated the telecommunications industry, we had the tigers in the east, Russia collapsed, The thing that came out was what I call market-based governance. That is, we tend to vouchers for school are a market-based concept applied to public education. So that's the force, that was a major force, an ideology out there that says if there's any industry out there that we can privatize and put into a market structure, we ought to do it. Now, there's a big argument whether it's better to fly today than it used to be. If you're back in what my wife calls cattle class, it's sometimes tough, you know. But on the other hand, tickets are cheap. So you trade things. Some of you maybe want to go back to Ma Bell. I don't know. So there's goods and bads with it, but we clearly are moving that way. And as a result of that, you have this ideology. God, I knew I was going to lose this thing. Is there a way to stop this from doing that? I kind of quit talking, right? Okay, but anyway, so we have this ideology going. And utilities got involved in it. The other thing that as a result of the oil shocks in the 70s, there was a law passed by Congress called PURPA, Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act. It essentially was the first act where it became possible for somebody beside a utility to build a power plant. Before that, no one could build power plants except utilities. They had what's called a national monopoly. They were a franchise system. They're the only ones that could build power plants, and so nobody could build. That law actually focused on renewables and cogeneration. I'll talk about that a little bit. And then in 1992, there was passed the EPA of 1992, which is the Electrical Policy Act of 1992, which opened up the transmission system. Before that, the only people that could control transmissions were utilities. If they didn't want somebody to put their electricity on the transmission, they stopped. They had absolute power over that. This law opened up the transmission system and said, you've got to let everybody use it. It's basically the highway for electricity, and you've got to open up the highway to everybody. And that was a major, major move. And so people got into it. The other thing at the same time, all this was going on, we, of course, had the whole establishment of the environmental movement. We finally have to decide that man really can't conquer nature, that man really has to live in a symbiotic relationship with nature, and we're still struggling over that concept. We're still trying to figure it out, you know. We've got pressure on forests, we've got pressures on fisheries, we've got pressures on, you know. We still haven't gotten used to the idea that man is going to conquer. The endangered species that exists as man or humankind today. It's not, if we're gone, the earth will recover, I assure you. So there's a great deal. We had the Environmental Policy Act, which came into it, so other forces were at work. And the whole question of global climate change. And that's been in the headlines. I was in Washington, D.C. on Thursday and Friday. I met with some people who had met with Vice President Cheney. They have not a clue what the president is going to say over in Europe on Monday, okay, in terms of global climate change. Well, except Europe has gone much further in putting carbon taxes in place, in pushing renewables in place, and they really have gone way beyond what we do today. So there's an issue of how we're going to do this, and I don't think that, well, let me put it this way. There's a Faustian bargain at work. We essentially have hundreds of years worth of fossil fuel, and all of a sudden we have to make a decision that we're not going to use it. That is a very, very tough decision. And it's not going to be easy, and I don't know how we're going to work out of it. The other thing that's happened during this time is a technology shift. Essentially, most of this century we had what I would call boiler-type power plants. They're essentially tea kettles. You boil water in them, you take the steam runs an electrical generator and makes electricity. The bigger you make them, the more efficient, the higher the temperature you operate them at, the cheaper they become. And if you take a look at the curve of electrical costs over the last 100 years, it goes just like this. This is where you started out with Edison and early days of Westinghouse. And what happened, the power plants got bigger and bigger and bigger. Prices got cheaper and cheaper. Utilities basically said, hey, the bigger we build them, the better they are, but we need protection of some sort. We actually devised the regulatory system that existed in the country, the so-called concept of natural monopoly, that this was the best way to do this and work it. This came to an end in about 1960. That is, the boiler-type power plant reached its technological limit. You couldn't bring the pressures up anymore. You couldn't bring the temperatures up anymore because you ran into metal fatigue limits. And so all of a sudden, this whole thesis of build them bigger, make it cheaper, came to a grinding halt. And it was not perceptible at the beginning, and you know how these things always have an overshoot. You don't see them right off the bat. What happened is now that you came into being with a whole different set of technologies, and the primary one being the gas turbine. The gas turbine is an outcome of millions of dollars, billions of dollars of research poured in during the Cold War on the improvement of jet engines for military aircraft. That technology transferred over into the development of gas turbines for utility use. And as a matter of fact, utilities were not the ones to first see that. When PURPA happened and the other people outside of the utility people were able to use other technologies to make electricity, they went to gas turbines. Utilities always felt gas turbines were only good for peaking units and you can't run them base loaded. And it turns out they used them and found out it worked. And so you have now a whole different way of doing it. This is not something based.
They weren't
cost-effective
by the time until a certain point?
No, you have to shift from an industrial type turbine design to a jet aircraft engine turbine design. Yeah. Yeah, you basically, it's an APU, it's an aircraft jet engine. When a 747 takes off, each engine in the 747 is about a 25 megawatt power plant. So when a 747 takes off, it's 100 megawatts taking off. Okay? And they run for hours. They change them out, and they operate them worldwide. And so utilities did not trust them to run continuously, but airlines flew them all the time. Okay? So it took a while for those cultures. And the culture couldn't accept that. It's based on something else. And so it wasn't until outside people came in with them that you actually saw them happen. So this means you guys need to shift to smaller plants. And in fact, more fundamentally, it meant that the energy technology shifted from a technology which was based upon construction skill, large nuclear power plants, large power plants, to a technology which was mass-produced, production-based. That is, economy of scale in the old technology was build them bigger. The economy of scale in the new technology is get more of them. And that's it doesn't sound like much, but it is a very, very fundamental thought shift. It's a different way of operating. And that was actually introduced into the system through PURPA, when outside people were allowed to come and bring new technology into the system. Now, this is PURPA. The other thing that that PURPA did is that it required that the utilities actually say what it costs them to produce electricity. Before then, you always got one number. But that number was what it took to produce the electricity, what it took to transmit the electricity, what it took to distribute the electricity, what it took to have all of the overhead costs, what it took to have spare, all that. You just got one number, X dollars per kilowatt hour. Okay? This is the first time utilities were required to break out and say, what does it cost you to produce electricity? And then you turn around and you say, okay, now here's you other guys that aren't utilities, and you want to make electricity. Can you beat that price? And they did. And they beat it all over the place. And what happened, what California did at that point, they went a little further. They did and said, why is it so slow to get these other people to produce anything? And the reason was that you had to negotiate a contract with utilities. Okay. Now, the utility is an 80-pound gorilla.
and you're a little guy with a couple of wind turbines, and you're out there, you know, trying to negotiate a contract. Well, they can negotiate forever if it doesn't hurt them, right? You're out of money in no time at all. Right? In fact, I met with one of the senior vice presidents on some schedule. I came out of the Air Force where schedules were important. And he said, Carl, you don't understand the utility business. He said, time is our ally. Just keep negotiating with these guys. They'll eventually go away. You know? So that was recognized. Okay? And so they put in place, John, I do have to talk faster and learn how to do this thing. All right. Let me go back. That shows you. I'm thinking of George's opening talk about the webcast and all that stuff. Whoops. And all that. And I thought about it. And you know, when I was going to school at Berkeley, where is that? If he'd opened a lecture with what he said those first few minutes, there wouldn't have been a student in the place that knew what in the hell he was talking about. You know? Absolutely a different set of things. What the standard offer actually did, it reduced transaction costs. It basically said, here's a standard offer. If you guys can meet it, sign the bottom line, and you got a contract with utility. The minute that happened, thousands of megawatts of renewables and cogeneration appeared on the scene in California. In fact, so much of it that in 1985, the Public Utilities Commission cut off standard offers. They were getting more megawatts than they wanted, and the utilities were screaming, okay? And so, but they had to be in renewable, and they had to be in cogeneration. So the early wind turbines that you saw out in Altamont Pass, and the early ones you saw down south, were the result of these standard offer four contracts. Okay? And this was early, early technology. This was, you're talking 80s. You're talking 10, 15 years ago.
But and it was just... major sort of big machine mentality people were defending, saying, no, we can't have anywhere. That's really the
perfect
abortion.
That's right. We got too many of them. And basically, they were also in the process of building a couple of nuclear power plants at the time, if you remember. Diablo Canyon and down south. So we had some big clashes going on. The other thing that happened was the Energy Policy Act of 1992, which basically opened up the transmission system. It said everybody can use the wire. Doesn't matter whether you're utility or not. Utilities, you cannot control it. You must have this non-discriminatory access to the transmission. You can't put your own plants on there first. Now, the real impact of this was that it essentially made the decision that the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, was in charge of interstate electricity sales. So that meant that since all transmission lines leave states, the only state that has all of its transmission lines within the state is Texas. Texas is the only isolated state. Everybody, they do not have to listen to FERC. FERC has no jurisdiction within Texas, okay? All other states, it's interstate transfer, the electricity flows across state lines, FERC is in charge. So basically the state lost control of its wholesale market as a result of the Energy Policy Act of 1972. The federal government, you basically transferred that government. And then as a result of restructuring, you began to put in with a word you've probably seen in the paper, ISO. ISO is the independent system operator who is supposed to operate the transmission system with not discriminating against anybody with all kinds of rules. But the rules under which the ISO operates are determined by FERC. Yes?
I've never been able to visualize how you prevent electricity from co-mingling on the transmission lines.
You don't.
Yeah.
You have to think of the transmission line as a lake, and you have to think of power plants as springs or little rivers flowing into the lake, and then you have somebody with a pump pulling water out of the lake, or flowing out. That's the best one I know of. Once it's in the lake, you don't know whose electrons is whose.
Well, it seems like a good idea to have a FERC, because the FERC is like the equivalent of, say, the ITC as far as trucking, goods across state lines and everything, right?
Yes.
The Interstate Commerce Commission is equivalent in a sense, trying to govern.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, theoretically, it's not a. It's definitely what you want to do. The problem is, that you just have to recognize. And in fact, the reason I say that is because if you notice, one of the big aspects is that FERC says, California, this is your problem, go fix it. And we're saying, hey, wait a minute, you guys are supposed to be fixing this problem. This is an interstate problem, right? Yeah. It's not an intrastate problem. And FERC says, hey, if you just pay enough and wait long enough, the market will fix it, right?
That argument, you know, the
effort saying, well, you say it's an interstate problem, but don't you have room in that little Rhode Island state of yours to have enough generation from the people because you've got, you know, where's your power line? Is that what they're saying?
Basically, what they're saying is that
you need to let the market work, and if you let the market work, they'll eventually straighten themselves out. Now, they also have by law the requirement to see that the prices in the wholesale markets are just and reasonable. And they have actually declared last fall that the prices were unjust and unreasonable and have decided to do nothing about it. The interesting interplay to me is the fact that the guy who is head of FERC, Hebert, is a protege of Lott. And essentially he's head of FERC because Lott pressured Bush to put it in charge. So now that Lott is out of the Senate, you're going to see a shift in chairman. Pat Woods of Texas is going to take over as chairman. So you're going to see some power shifts. Now, he's probably not going to be able to cap prices, but he's going to be much more amenable to taking a look at what's happening with it.
This is a toss-out argument because price caps, all that really does is simply set a theoretical limit, and everybody's obviously going to jump to that limit and try to simply push for
it. Well, It depends on whether you think there are mechanisms by which you could temporarily fix the runaway market. Okay? If you think of permanent price caps, that's probably the wrong thing to do. On the other hand, if you take a look at what's being charged in some cases today, it bears no resemblance to the cost of production whatsoever. So one of the ways of capping would be to say, okay, here's the price of natural gas, here's the price to produce electricity from natural gas, here's a profit of 50%, that's the cap.
So there's
ways of dealing with that aspect of it. The FERC has the right to forbid people to not enter the market if they're not playing the game right. Okay? They can exclude generators from the market if they think they're not dealing fairly. Okay, but they've not exercised any of that power, and frankly, I'm not sure they necessarily have the skill level in FERC to deal properly with the problem. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of things, and
do they have any say so over that